And welcome to Where Did the Road Go, where tonight we'll be talking about the wonderful documentary that is available on YouTube, The Fairy Faith. With me is Soraya Azkath.
Hi.
And Red Pill Junkie.
Hi.
in Mickey Mouse Club. Hi.
Oh, boy.
And this is Bizarro Universe, where Josh is hosting the show.
Yeah, everything's upside down and backwards. So just a little bit of background on this particular documentary. I discovered it probably about 5 years ago. I remember that I was cooking dinner in my apartment at the time, and I was looking for, this is way before I was involved in Fortean of any sort. And I was, cooking dinner in my apartment, and I was looking for things to listen to on YouTube. And I remember distinctly, finding this as one of the YouTube recommendations at the end of a separate video. I don't know what that video was, but I remember that this particular documentary came on, and I remember that it took me about twice to three times as long to make dinner because I kept on stopping and just like staring at the computer. I've had quite a soft space for this documentary for a long time. As I mentioned, it is available on YouTube to watch for free. It's about an hour and 15 minutes long, I believe. But there are a couple things that I really do love about this documentary. Number one is the sense of mood that it really does exude. The entire production is very well put together. But what that well put together production does is that it really does tend to emphasize an aspect of the fairy folk that I don't think that you see in a lot of other documentaries. A lot of other documentaries that you find on YouTube or such places about the fae folk tend to underemphasize the sinister nature of what they do. And I feel, after having watched this on at least an annual basis, and I literally mean that, every year since I discovered it, I've watched it at least once a year, that there is a very sinister undertone that is maintained throughout the entire documentary, all the way through the end, which you don't get with a lot of other fairy documentaries. A lot of other fairy documentaries will talk about consciousness raising and about how there are earth spirits here to save the world, which are not things that I necessarily disagree with. But there is a sinister side to this phenomena that is underrepresented in other YouTube videos on the subject, and I feel like the professionalism with which this is done, in addition to the that sort of like really sort of dark tone, really does sell sort of the concept of the fae as earth spirits. I feel like for me, this particular documentary has always tapped into an experience that I think all of us have had. The forest is a beautiful place to go. We all go out into the forest to seek solace, or those of us who have access to a forest, rather, go out into the forest to seek solace. And it can be a very calm and reassuring place, but anyone who has ever been in a forest when an intense wind has moved through the trees, I think we all get that sort of sense of a chill going up our spine when we look up and we see the leaves moving and of their own accord, and that sort of overwhelming sound of the wind rushing through the leaves. To me, that's what this documentary in a lot of ways sort of encapsulates, is that idea of this unfettered aspect of nature that is very primal to all of us and shared by world cultures, and one that we as people, especially in the Western world, are out of touch with. And for the first time, I've been able to wrangle my fellow podcast companions, Soraya Azkath and Red Pill Junkie, into watching this. And I'm extremely eager to hear their input on this. I have a list of notes that I accumulated for this last time of watching it, but have accumulated sort of over the years of watching it, some nuances. And I would love to hear their feedback on what they thought of this. As long as it's not, oh, it was crap. So, Soraya, I'll let you start with this.
Oh, I thought you didn't want to hear that it was crap.
Oh, throw it all out.
So when I started watching this, he deals a lot in the beginning there with, like, you know, he's asking kids if they believe in fairies. And although the comment that killed me is the one girl says, well, we know the tooth fairy's real, so why not other fairies? And I'm thinking, this is an argument that other people have in their adult world. They may not believe in the tooth fairy, but they believe in things that are unproven and then say, well, this is real, so why not that? But the beginning of it, I was kind of like, why is he making me watch this? And that maybe the first 10 minutes or so, because he's really just dealing with like the childish belief in fairies. And then he gets up to Brian Froud. And Brian Froud's artwork's amazing. He's just such a good artist. And from that point on, I thought the documentary was actually quite interesting.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't know, Brian Froud was the primary artist consultant on Labyrinth, Jim Henson's Labyrinth, which was which actually features his son in the titular role of the baby in Labyrinth. Interestingly enough,
that's right.
But yeah, that's sort of what I love about this is that it does go to that dark place of fae folklore, but it sort of is like the stealth escalation of things where you sort of start off in this lighthearted sort of manner and then it ends up getting darker and darker. But again, I have to, you know, after having seen this multiple times, I see those initial scenes. And I have to sort of wonder how those dovetail with what I've found about how children perceive the paranormal, about how children are more open to that. And sort of having seen this multiple times and being involved in this, it sort of frames those in a different light for me. But yeah, I totally agree with that. Like the first time you see it, it's like, yeah, this is something very passive that I can sort of half pay attention to. But then it gets very interesting very quickly. Miguel, what are your thoughts?
Well, it's interesting. If we go with the idea that in the documentary, they ask children, or they ask people who believe in the faithful, and some of the people interviewed, they say that they actually saw fairies when they were very young, but then they somehow lost the ability to perceive them. And obviously, in folklore, we explain that as, you know, the loss of innocence, you know, because that is what they say is what gives youngsters the ability to see these liminal entities. But maybe it's not innocence per se, but some sort of conditioning that is imposed into young and malleable minds, in that they are forced to view, perceive reality in a certain fixed way, the accepted way that is, you know, accepted by the status quo. Another alternative interpretations are not only discouraged or frowned upon, they are ridiculed, and they are even become a threat, you know, if someone starts to deviate from the status quo, the sanctioned way of perceiving reality, well, you might end up in an insane asylum, and that is also mentioned during the documentary.
Yeah, it is, and it's really fascinating to me that they begin the documentary in that way, because it's sort of disarming in a lot of ways. Which sort of ties in what Soraya said. The probably for me, the most engaging thing in those first, like, that, I don't know, 10 minutes or so, is the concept of the braided manes, which seems like a throwaway thing, unless you're involved in Fortiana as a general whole, where you hear these stories that are quite common of Bigfoot braiding horses' manes, and does that mean that Bigfoot is mistaken for fairy activity, braiding horses' manes, or is fairy activity mistaken for Bigfoot activity? Or are they one and the same? And that's one of those moments that I always really love from the beginning of the documentary, is that particular aspect. But as Soraya said, once Brian Froud enters, the whole documentary sort of takes on a different tone. And I think he's the first person to really sort of acknowledge this sinister aspect to fairy folklore, and part of that is due to his art. I believe, Soraya, you've been familiar with Froud's art in the past, and I personally feel that it's very evocative and that it sort of really does capture the dark side of fairy folklore in a very compelling way. How do you feel about that, Soraya?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he has a his artwork on this stuff is like no one else's. And it's just, it definitely captures that sinister edge to it. And it's just, it's perfect for what it is.
Yeah, I love that moment in the documentary. And again, I encourage anyone who hasn't seen it yet to watch it. There's that wonderful moment when he turns the painting upside down.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like a magic eye puzzle. Like the one way up, it looks like a nice, pleasant fairy, but he turns it upside down, it looks like this other sort of more malevolent fairy.
And I forget exactly how he explains what fairies are to him, but the explanation was fantastic. It was like kind of like they're a part of nature, they're kind of intertwined with nature or something like that.
Yeah, it's sort of this idea that
that they inhabit an in between states.
Yeah, fairy is the spirit that embodies just action in general, not only physicality but action in general. So snags are the result of fairy, because there's something in charge of snags. And it's, you know, it's interesting. I'm sort of leapfrogging ahead a little bit to some of Eddie Lanahan's bits, but it's always been fascinating to me how Christianity has had to, in the British Isles, cope with the idea of fairy acting as trying to fit the idea of fairy folk into the cosmology, which to me has never really seemed to be a real issue. You know, I find it ironic that Christianity can accept the ideas of good spirits and evil spirits, but not neutral spirits. But I think that there's some wealth in this multi-tiered spirit idea. Do either of you have anything to say about, or anything, any ideas about, like, this idea of how that might fit into someone's personal cosmology in 21st century Western world?
My own personal take of it is that ascribing benevolence or malevolence to these entities is a very arbitrary thing to do. I mean, when I rewatched the documentary, it made me think that society gets the fae folk or the aliens that they kind of like expect to, you know, how in the 1950s, when people started to claim to have contact with the Space Brothers, it was a time of, I don't know, maybe more of a innocence or more of a trying to find salvation from after all the devastation caused by World War II. And then, you know, these Space Brothers were all about love and light and about, you know, raising consciousness and about helping humanity evolve from its lowly state. But then, you know, things became more complex, and then society kind of turned on its head, and then the aliens became, instead of being saviors, then became invaders. You know, that's where people like David Jacobs or Bud Hopkins, you know, kind of like went with their research, or at least with their personal interpretation of the research. And now we are talking about how in the documentary first they kind of like portray the fae folk in a very, you know, interesting, you're like, oh well, you know, these benevolent creatures of the forest and all that, and then, you know, they're starting to say, well, wait a minute, you know, actually, you know, the fae folk is far, the fae folklore is far more intricate, and there is, you know, very negative connotations to it. But again, I feel that is a kind of a, like an unfair assessment, because to me, the fae folk, like you said, you know, it's all about this aspect of nature. And to say that the fae folk are good or bad is almost like saying that nature is either good or bad. You know what I mean? Take, for example, the sea. You know, I mean, sailors and fishermen, people who live from the sea, you know, they will perceive the sea to be a provider, you know, a giver of life. But at the same time, the sea can be also treacherous, and the sea can also be merciless, you know, when there's a storm, or when there's a hurricane, or when something happens, or the creatures inhabiting the sea, you know, that can be predators that don't really hesitate to attack men who are supposed to be like the kings of creation, right? So what I feel about the faithful is that they kind of like remind us to have respect for nature, because if you don't have respect for nature, then you will pay the consequences. Not because nature is evil, but because nature is relentless, I guess.
Well, it's almost Lovecraftian in that sense. It's sort of indifferent. Mm-hmm. But you know, you mentioned the similarities between aliens and fae folk, and they pay a little bit of lip service to that in the documentary. They mention some sort of parallels very briefly.
Yeah, very briefly.
But I have very nuanced feelings about this, but I don't think I've ever pinned you guys down. Where do you think the fae folk alien thing overlaps? Because I personally feel like I remain open to things, and it's part of my credo is I hope that in a year from now I will say something completely different, because that's sort of the Ed Robert Anton Wilson, Greg Bishop model of thinking. But I feel like we are seeing different sides of the same phenomena. But I've never really pinned the two of you down in sort of a way to say, like, where do you think the intersection is between fae folk and alien folk? Do you think we're seeing similar sides of different sides of the same thing, or different things using similar methods, or how do you feel like that whole can of worms coalesces? I'm mixing like a thousand different metaphors here, but you get my gist. So, Ryan, do you want to go first?
I think the simple answer is, yeah, I think it's the same phenomena with different faces. I don't think either face is what it actually is. Yeah. I think it's just the way we interpret it based on our environment and who we are and where we are at the time. I mean, it's possible there's something else to it. You know, you have things like and like Dr. Greer's little, you know, 10-inch alien there that turned out to be human. Well, what is that? You know, I mean, could there be real little people running around somewhere? They may not have magical powers, but it could then lead to mythology that gets based around something like that as well. So you could have different aspects of it depending on the encounter.
Yeah, Miguel?
Well, something that I've been going back and forth for the last, I don't know, 6-7 years. I mean, yeah, I kind of like tend to think that this is the same phenomenon, but whether we are interpreting it differently due to our cultural baggage, or if the phenomenon is reacting or trying to portray itself under a different guise, you know, because of an ulterior motive, it's maybe impossible to answer. And the interesting thing that it's mentioned during the documentary is that one of the basic aspects of the nature of the faithful is that they are shapeshifters, so they can manipulate human perception. They can present themselves however they want to, and you know that tells you something. So it's almost like in a pop culture example, it's like in the Harry Potter movies, you know, the Bogart. You know, what is the true shape of the Bogart? Well, no one can really knows because it changes according to the person who is observing it.
That reminds me a bit, in a way, of something that came out about Fort Fest this last week, or rather 2 weeks ago. Time flies. Where I, there was someone in the audience who raised her hand and said, "The fairies accept offerings of milk and bread and honey," and it was like a full stop. And I was like, "Look, I respect you, and I respect a lot of what you've done, but having said that, you're not looking at the fae as a global phenomenon. And if you look at fairy folk as a global phenomenon, they accept a lot more than that. If you look at it in the British Isle lens, it definitely conforms to those norms. But if you look at it in sort of a global lens,
sure.
They come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, and they like all sorts of things. And that comes to that shape-shifting idea. I mean, there are certain entities in Polynesian islands that are supposedly like water lizards that sort of guard pools of water and let passengers across and whatnot. That definitely conform to those sort of fairy sort of guidelines. Again, shapeshifters, sort of reptilian idea. I'm going in sort of a couple of different directions with my notes here, but I have to wonder, speaking about this global phenomena, what I find really interesting about this documentary is that it's a fae folk documentary from a Canadian point of view, and the documentary eventually circles back around to that, to the Canadian import idea. We know that, like, there are obviously Native American tribes that have a robust little people tradition. But it's really interesting to me that some of the people in this particular part of Canada, and Lord knows it escapes me at this moment, but they sort of import these beliefs, and even the native people from this region still see the little people and have sort of like syncretized the settlers' beliefs with their own native beliefs. Do either of you have anything to make out of that, like any insights into that? Like, what does that say about the phenomena as a whole, that it's able to be synthesized in that sort of way?
I think that's just par for the course for it, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, I would tend to agree.
In the end, it's really difficult to ascertain, you know, because all these cultural manifestations and interpretations that they have at the very basic, you know, one thing in common, you know, they are all human interpretations. We're all human. We all tend to perceive the world more or less the same way because we are all equipped with the same kind of, like, you know, sensory perception apparatus, right? You know, the our brains are kind of like hardwired pretty much the same way. We're all using stereoscopic vision, our eyes. They all are able to perceive light on the same wavelengths and all of that. So maybe that will be kind of like a materialistic way to try to say why there are these commonalities, but then again, maybe the commonalities arise for different reasons. You know, maybe, I mean, if we humans have managed to colonize the whole world in just, 200,000 years after our ancestors left Africa, so what if there was a more ancient species, you know, that managed to conquer the whole world much, much earlier, you know, and we're just in the new guys, you know, and we just managed to find that all the places that we ended up discovering, or so we thought, well, they were all already taken, you know.
Nice. I like that. And you know, go ahead, Sora. Please.
The thing that also surprised me about this, which we just found out as we started this was actually released in 2000. I would have pegged it for like the late 1970s.
Mm. Yeah, the aesthetic is very earthy in that sense. And I think that I'd like to think that in some sense that's deliberate. But in some other sense, I think that it is very unintentional. I think the subject matter just sort of lends it more to that sort of aesthetic. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned commonalities, Miguel, and that sort of brings me back to these ideas of commonalities. And I think commonalities in terms of the, we like to think that if you want to see the Fae folk, you have to go to the British Isles. And that's one of the closet reasons that I want to go to the British Isles in a strong way. but I think that commonalities really do arise out of culture. And if you think about, to be really cynical about it, I think that, you know, that there was at one point where they said that the sun never set on the British Empire. And I think in a cynical way, it's easy to interpret that as, you know, part of the reason that fairy faith is sort of widely disseminated. I mean, you look at the Duende faith, the Duende belief in Latin America is a direct export of Portugal, where that's just spelled a little bit differently, but it's still Duendes. But at the same time, I can't help but think that there must be some sort of commonality to all these experiences that are reflected in that sort of way. Speaking of sort of commonalities, one of these commonalities that we see is this concept of fairy artifacts. And it's exemplified in the documentary by the fairy flag, which looks sort of piss poor, pardon my French. But these idea of fairy artifacts are not at all uncommon. You'll find fairy boots, you'll find fairy chalices, and you'll find fairy flags, which, look, I think all three of us are very much sympathetic to consciousness-based models of the phenomena, but these sort of very mundane, tangible artifacts really do fly in the face of sort of the views that we tend to espouse here on shows like Where Did the Road Go. So how does this sort of, these sort of very tangible, weird, mundane artifacts sort of fit into your cosmology of the unexplained?
Well, it's the same with UFOs. It tends to be that monkey wrench.
Yep.
You know, it's like, oh, you can explain this all with shifts of consciousness. Oh, and you got a flag. Or you got a pancake. Or you got, you know, slag that fell off the spaceship.
Well, that's right. No one's ever talked to me about alien pancakes. I don't
exactly. But, you know, and both in the fairy faith and the UFO world, it all ends up being fairly mundane stuff. Even the implants that people have removed. I mean, you're not getting stuff that's completely out of this world where we're going, oh, my God, this is, you know, extraterrestrial in some way. It's definitely something technologically advanced in some way that we can't quite figure out its purpose or, you know, what we're looking at. It may also just be a decoy that it's, you know, there for us to find. But again, it shows that similarity between the UFO phenomena and the fairy faith, that you do have these things that you can bring back to show some sort of physical reality. What that reality consists of, who the hell knows?
So if
Let me interject here because, you know, when I was watching the documentary and they show the purported Fae flag, as a Mexican, the first thing that came to mind was the Ayate of Juan Diego with the visage of the Virgin of Guadalupe, you know, which is also... Mm. A very highly venerated object that is supposed to have a supernatural origin.
Yeah, and to clarify, this was the gentleman who was told by the Virgin to collect a sash of flowers, right?
Exactly, of roses.
Yeah.
You know, roses of Castilia that weren't supposed to be growing in, you know, in the middle of December when the apparitions took place. But obviously, you know, the Ayate is still on display at the Basilica Guadalupe. Everyone can look at it. And you can say, well, there's nothing, you know, supernatural or, you know, paranormal about this. It just looks like a really old painting, you know, of the typical religious iconography. But if you take into consideration that this painting is being managed to be preserved for more than 500 years in a really, really crude medium, which is this, you know, ayate, that is made of a really, really crude and primitive cloth, you know, that shouldn't have stood the test of time, even if it has been taken care of, you know, and having been maintained by the Catholic Church in Mexico. So those little things, and also things like these studies that some people have conducted about the eyes of the Virgin Mary, and how it seems to, if you look at the pupils of the Virgin Mary and with a microscope, and it's, some people say that you can almost distinguish the people that were present when Juan Diego, you know, presented the ayate to the Sumaraga bishop. So what I'm getting at here, getting back to the documentary, is that, you know, okay, we have these objects that, on the one hand, they have this tradition that they were, you know, given to humanity by these non-human entities. But then if you look at them at first sight, they look to be, you know, just ordinary common things. But maybe the unordinary thing about them is kind of like hidden from us, unless we look at them with from a different perspective. You know, I mean, that's my interpretation of it, at least.
Well, to sort of paraphrase something that C.S. Lewis said, the fact that it's ordinary is unordinary in that particular case. And that sort of reminds me of the sort of idea that I've had about the phenomena, capital T to capital P, for a while, is that if human civilization or human perception equals X, then the other's technology equals X plus one. So
right.
In the case of Virgin of Guadalupe, it's this sort of like, you know, perennial flower bouquet. For the faithful, it was flags. And I think in modern abduction cases, to tie back to what you said, Soraya, it's sort of implants. Coming back around to a quick aside, because we sort of leapfrogged ahead to him, but like to sort of address this guy, Eddie Lanahan is like, whenever you see him pop up in a fairy documentary with his giant ass beard, it is a moment to treasure, because I would love to talk to this guy sometime. I'm surprised at myself that I haven't talked to this guy, because he seems to be a wealth of institutional knowledge in terms of Great Britain. But he's somebody that shows up in British documentaries about fairies. And whenever he does, I really do tend to think it lends this edge of legitimacy to it. I found it really fascinating, his ideas about the fairy tree, the singular fairy tree in which an entire road should be routed around, and the ways that parallels, you know, the stories that we've referenced numerous times about boulders in Iceland or certain hidden folk areas in Iceland where entire roads are diverted around boulders, or areas where the hidden folk are supposedly congregating to protect them. And I really find that possibly it was a Nordic Viking import to the British Isles, but it's one of those things that, along with, you know, in my research, the food taboo seems a little bit too coincidental to completely write off as a cultural diffusionism. It seems like there's some sort of truth there. Whether or not it's a literal truth in terms of like elemental beings inhabiting a particular geographic landmark or not, it seems like there's some sort of fundamental force that makes human beings wary of disrupting that particular aspect of the terrain. Do either of you have any thoughts on that?
I don't think it's diffusionism. I do think there's something to it. And I've mentioned before, like with David Politis missing 411 stuff, a lot of these people are found in boulder fields.
Precisely.
And that connects directly to that whole Icelandic thing. I mean, there's the strange disappearances and all the different tales of little people around the world all connect together. So I mean, with that, I think that I want to say that whatever's taking these people connects somehow to these mythological, these ancient beliefs of little people. Mm-hmm. It may not be, and that doesn't mean I think it's aliens, mm-hmm. nor do I necessarily think that UFOs are aliens, but it may not even be connected to the UFO phenomenon itself.
Nor does it mean it's not.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah. It's just that there are so many similarities, like when David Politis lists the commonalities in these disappearances, either where they disappear, how they disappear, or where they're found. And then you look at these ancient beliefs in the fairy faith in different countries, and you find the same things. Maybe part of that was also caused by people disappearing in these weird spots. And there's definitely plenty of tales like that.
To me, one of the really, really fascinating aspects of the documentary is when they like go into exploring the aspect of Earth energy in trying to find maybe a possible explanation for the faith folk, yeah, or the faith folklore.
There's a guy in the documentary who like invests in dowsing rods, which I thought was interesting.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so the whole aspect of trying to maybe interpret this folklore or these human beliefs in terms of human reaction to Earth energy, both positive and negative. You know, that to me was fascinating because it then harkens back to this whole concept of ley lines and also all these megalithic sites and the idea that our ancestors were more attuned to these energies and they had a more intimate and a more respectful approach to them. And now, well, obviously this has been largely lost in most of the modern cultures, with, you know, the honorable exceptions of, for example, Iceland, as you guys mentioned it, how they still, you know, go and, you know, detour a construction road if it happens to intersect or go, you know, near a boulder that is said to be inhabited by the elves. And some people will say, well, you know, that's just silly superstition. But to me, it still seems to be a very elegant and a very interesting way to try to have a relationship with nature, right? I mean, okay, maybe it's a way mm-hmm. in which humans were taught to respect nature, you know, using, you know, these traditions of, well, ascribing nature to a certain, like, personality, right? You know, a certain, the same way we always tend to anthropomorphize forces that are beyond our control. But if it works, you know, then, you know, why change it? You know, if in Iceland, trying to respect the boulders where the elves are said to live manages to have, you know, safer roads, then, right. You know, like you guys in the documentary, the guy you mentioned, he's trying to try to save this bush, this lonely bush where the faithful yeah. live. And he's saying, you know, I wonder, you know, if they build this road, look after all the casualties that will happen, you know, like 10 years from now. And that was an interesting idea, you know, maybe trying to see what happens where those sacred sites are not respected. You know, what are the casualties or the consequences of not respecting these places where apparently the energy of the earth is concentrated.
Well, you know, it sort of makes me wonder if A, if a longitudinal study would be done on certain Fey locations being disrespected. A, if it would show any sort of results. And B, if those results will be established or just written off, as they usually are. Because, you know, it's one thing to, like, if I were to do a study of a site where Icelandic construction workers plowed through a Fey boulder and they destroyed everything, you wouldn't be able to put it into these nice, tidy scientific boxes in terms of, like, you know, X number of deaths happened or injuries happened. No, it would be injuries. It would be people getting sick. It would be people's relatives getting sick. It would be equipment breaking down. It would be,
right.
You know, it wouldn't fit into any of those nice, tidy boxes. So I wonder, A, if that would even be noticed, and B, if it would be, you know, respected at all.
I want to say I've heard of areas that were, you know, not respected like that, having higher accident rates, but I don't remember where, and I can't really point to it exactly. So it's just something that stuck in my mind when I heard that. I'm thinking, hasn't there been some speculation that certain areas are more accident prone because they were sacred areas that weren't respected?
Well, you know, as one of the 8 male white people across the globe at age 30 who was obsessed with Fey folklore, I've seen enough anecdotal evidence to suggest that there's plenty of testimony to that fact, that the disrespect of certain areas, and you could sort of extrapolate this across, you know, an Anglo-centric, sort of, prism and see that, I wouldn't doubt it if there are certain desecrations of Anglican graveyards that have repercussions, or certain Native American graveyards that have certain repercussions with them as well.
Poltergeist.
Yeah, exactly. It's, your house is,
at least there's the belief of it anyway.
I'm house hunting right now, so my question is always, is this built over an Indian burial ground? That's question number one.
Yes, great. I will take
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Funny anecdote. Actually, we were actually in a house today that we're going to put an offer on, and we heard this strange noise, and my wife and my realtor all look at each other, and we're like, oh my God, what is – and I'm like, yes, this is a selling point. And I walk in the other room. It's a chain dangling on the ceiling fan. So. But
a while ago, I had written – I was talking to Patrick Harper about David Politis's work too, and I thought we should include this here. He said – it struck me immediately as soon as I heard about the mention of disappearances while berry picking, how well many of these stories mesh with fairy lore, where fairies often abduct people while berry picking. They happen in Ireland, of course, but are well documented by the folklore department at St. John's University and I think Rhode Island. And he sent me an article he had written called Going Astray. And there was one segment. I'm not going to read the whole thing. You can actually write Patrick Harper and tell him you want to read Going Astray, and he'll send it out to you. I think it was I forget what magazine it was initially published in, but I would post it, but he's not sure he has the rights to it despite having written it. And it says, an even stranger tale of McManus's concerns a 19-year-old girl companion to his aunt who went on her day off to visit a neighbor. When she had not returned for supper at 7 p.m., search parties were dispatched. They looked everywhere for her until at about midnight, the girl turned up at the house and collapsed in tears. She had made a detour, she explained, to climb Lys Ard, the famous fairy fort on McManus Land. She had climbed the slope of the hill around which the bank and ditch of the fort ran and walked along the beech wood at the top. However, when she tried to leave, walking toward a gap in the bank, she felt a queer kind of jerk, a muscular jerk inside her rather than from the outside. And before she realized what had happened, she found herself walking away quickly in the opposite direction. When she turned and headed once more for the gap, the same thing happened. Whatever way she tried to get out, she felt as if there was an invisible barrier preventing her. As darkness fell, she became increasingly desperate, afraid to stop following the encircling barrier around the hill. She even saw a search party and could hear them calling for her, but they neither saw nor heard her cries. At last, all of a sudden, the barrier seemed to lift, and terrified and exhausted, she made her way home.
Yeah, that's one of those great stories that, to me, I mean, so, you have these fairy forts in the British Isles and sort of earthen mounds all over the world, and you have these earthen Indian mounds in the U.S., both of which are assumed with high strangeness. So part of me wonders if the common narrative, especially in the U.S., is that these Indian burial mounds, or these Indian mounds, as they were, often shaped in certain spirit animal shapes of snakes or certain mm-hmm. game. The common idea is that they were built by Indian civilizations because dwellings and artifacts of Native Americans have been found around there. But part of me wonders, what if those were there first and the civilization sort of sprung up around them? Because
it's entirely possible, and sometimes the Native Americans say that.
But you would never find that at all, except in sort of anthropological lore or documentation. But it's sort of interesting to me, those parallels, because those seem to be places of power in the capital P sort of sense.
And you also have to wonder: are these places created with a intention to draw power into them, to make them power places, or are they placed on power places?
Like accumulators.
Yeah. Because we don't know how this stuff works. We don't know what these power spots are. I know I've been in enough of them myself to know there's something weird about them, but we don't know what that is.
It's the old church cemetery argument in America. It's the idea that perhaps it's not that churches and cemeteries are sacred ground, but perhaps they've built on ground that is even, more anciently sacred than even they realize. This feels like a special place to build a church, and by extension, a graveyard. Anyone here know the great difference between a graveyard and a cemetery? By the way,
no.
A graveyard is attached to a church. Cemetery is discrete from a church, so it's entirely separate.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, the cemetery in Ithaca, and I talked about this in my Fort Fest presentation, where a lot of weird stuff has happened. I mean, to me, has nothing to do with the fact that it's a cemetery. I think it's just a power spot, and there is a Buddhist temple not two blocks away from it that is considered one of the it's like the North American seat for the Dalai Lama,
which is amazing. Like that's not coincidental to me at all.
So other graveyards in Ithaca, nothing. I've been in there, never had a weird experience, never felt anything weird, but this one has. Not only have I had experiences, but other people have had experiences. So again, was it built in a specific spot that already had some sacred design to it?
That's a great question, and I think it's a very valid question. It's the one that it's the sort of question that will lead us forward. It's not the sort of we've been sort of talking about science a lot on this particular session, but maybe not particularly in this podcast, because I think we separated this from the last one, but we've been talking about science a lot. It's sort of an unscientific question, but it's an important sort of idea that, like, perhaps there are these places of power, and that's what we should be turning our attention to, is these ideas that there is some sort of non-appreciated form of power that sort of congregates certain phenomena, certain areas. Speaking of
course,
go ahead.
The alternative there too would be, okay, it's a cemetery. Maybe the area is ripe for aggregating energy, and you have enough people there expressing, sadness and grief and stuff, and the area picks up on it and sort of concentrates it, whereas in other areas don't.
Well, speaking of like this congregation of emotion, this congregation of thought, this congregation of similar motivation, I find it fascinating that the fairies would often abduct violinists or rather fiddlers, fiddlers or harpists or musicians. And the idea that, Bud Hopkins was an artist, Whitley Strieber was a novelist. The idea that the phenomena, or those interested in the phenomena, I mean, like myself, I'm a musician. Miguel, you're someone with artistic dispositions. I find it interesting this phenomena either gravitates towards, or those who are artistic gravitate toward the phenomena. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, because this is definitely one of those consistencies that I don't think it's not as pronounced as like, oh, the missing time thing, or oh, the changeling mm-hmm. thing, or oh, the short entity thing. It's not as pronounced as that. It's a little bit more subtle. So what is this artistic bent in the phenomena, this artistic tendency to gravitate towards people with those interests? What does that mean to either of y'all? Miguel, I think that you're being someone that I really, whose artwork I really admire. I'd really appreciate your perspective on this.
I guess it's a question of whether intuition has a role to play in all of these, because to me, art is something that is, well, I mean, the stereotype is that it is something of a right brain activity, right? In opposition to left brain, which is analytical. I think that the biggest difference between the two rationality modes, you know, left brain, right brain, is the involvement of intuition. You know, to me, intuition is what can bridge the gap between A and D without the need to go from A to B and C. You know what I mean? I mean, there's this like way to obviate or to find the answer to the question, you know, without actually, you know, solving the problem in itself. It's like having the answer right in your pop up in your head. That to me is like one of the bases of art. You know, it's not like Picasso or all the greatest artists, Mozart, you know, they, you know, use some kind of like formula in order to create their sonatas or to create their paintings. Is something that is almost like, well, I've always said that artists are something of channelers, right? So if we're saying that they're channelers or even mediums, if we want to use the term, that means that artists get to be more attuned with some aspects of reality that some people really don't pay attention to, maybe because they are too preoccupied with more mundane things. So maybe that is one of the reasons why artists and paranormal phenomena get to confabulate or get to, you know, converge more often than not.
Yeah, the engineer finds the answer by going A, B, C, but the artist finds it by going A, D, C.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, it's interesting to me, because I find myself as an artist obviously gravitating towards non-materialistic answers for this, non-materialistic, the phenomena seems to be a little bit more fluid than we'd like to give it credit for in ufological circles. But there seem to be real consequences. I mean, like, you look at, like, Tales of Fae Destruction, again, the ideas of these particular landmarks being destroyed and there being literal real world physical consequences, which again, I think ties into the missing 411 thing. And there was that great Eddie Lenihan quote where they ask him if he's ever met the Fae. And he says he's never met them and he never wants to. Which I kind of would like to meet the Fae, which is sort of a weird thing to say out loud, because part of me is very much agnostic about the existence of such a thing, but I think that's preventing me from, that's sort of the barrier for me, preventing me from experiencing that. But do you think this is something that I mean, do you think this is something that should be reached out towards? Do you think this is something that we should that someone who's interested in this sort of thing should sort of like try to engage with in a Ouija board session? I mean, like, I don't think anybody involved in abductee lore or abductee research would ever say that you should try to be abducted, but it's different. It's different with spirit and fairy lore. Do you think this is something that should be contacted as another, or should just be a natural progression of being in the right space?
It's a hard question.
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't know if I've ever talked about these experiences, but I've had experiences with what I just consider nature spirits. Mm. Because I don't like to label things.
I don't think you have.
Yeah, and it used to happen all the time. Now it's fairly rare, but any time, especially around the change of seasons, I would see...
Liminal seasons, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. I would see shadows. Like when I was driving, I'd see shadows shoot across the road. And they were not animals. I could see them very clearly. And I was just... And eventually, you know, the first time I saw it, I was like, well, what the hell was that? Had to be an animal or something. But then as I got used to looking for them, I would realize there's no animal. They could be flat out in the headlights and you would just see a black ball as it shot across the road. And eventually I realized, you know, to the best of my way of describing it, they were nature spirits.
Hmm.
And the weirdest experience I had with it is I was standing outside this girl's house and we were fighting about something. And, we normally didn't fight. This was not someone I normally fought with. And we had just gotten into this fight. And the midway through the fight, suddenly these black shadows, little like cat-sized, come shooting across her lawn, weave around us, and take off through the backyard.
Hmm.
And I watched this and went, oh, that one doesn't happen often.
in the typical Soraya Azcat fashion. Oh. Huh, and that was strange. I guess I'll wait until tomorrow when it happens again.
and she just kind of stopped for a minute. And then I kind of looked at her and she goes, did you see that?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, what did you see? And she's like, I just watched a whole bunch of shadows just run around us. And I was like, yep, I saw that. And she's like, okay, can we go inside now?
Oh, man.
And it completely ended the fight. That was the other thing. Like, the fight was done right there.
You're not a Hayao Miyazaki fan, are you, Soraya?
Huh?
Are you
I'm not a what?
Fan of Hayao Miyazaki?
Never heard of it.
Oh, my God. My friend Totoro? Spirited Away? Do you like
anime? Sorry. Soraya, let me translate this into Southern English, which might be more palatable to the Hudson River Valley taste.
I don't know about
that. Miyazaki?
Miyazaki.
No, I'm understanding what he's saying. I just don't know who he is.
Oh my gosh.
Totoro, Spirited Away, all those films.
Nope. Well, not familiar.
Okay, it's all anime, but
so Joshua.
Wait, did you say it's anime?
Yeah, okay. Yes.
Joshua forced us to watch his faithful documentary. Now I'm asking you to watch My Friend Totoro for our next roundtable discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody gets...
I hate anime.
Do this for me, Soraya. You would...
I will hunt it down for you. You're going to have to send me the name because I'm not going to even try and spell it.
The reason I bring it up is because Miyazaki is very much about making this like very traditional Japanese folk tales, you know, fairy tales, if you want to call it, you know, and he loves to like portray spirits of nature into his films, you know, and most of the time these spirits of nature are portrayed as like shadowy figures, like moving through the forests.
Interesting.
Now I picked your attention, huh?
But you know, and I don't know if those things I saw were associated with what other people might see as the fairy faith, because I have no way of knowing. I don't know what they were. I just always it seemed to me, my sense was they had some connection to nature. And I had also done a series of magical workings, working my way through the different elements, trying to connect to the different types of elementals.
Yeah.
And that had some interesting results too, although I can't really give them to you off the top of my head and not really sure how much of it I should talk about, because some of it had some pretty quick responses when I would connect with these things. Yeah. Like there was a certain mode of behavior you'd have to be in or things went really badly very quickly.
Mm. Well, to sort of bring this – sorry, go ahead, Miguel. You're going to say something?
Because please, I wanted to answer also my take about you were asking whether people should actively pursue or to actively try to have some kind of engagement or have of contact with this aspect of reality, you know, these entities, if they truly exist. And my own take of it is like that is almost like asking whether a person should actively try to engage in psychedelics or not. And I think that depends on the people. That depends on the person, yes. You know, because psychedelics are like catalysts. They are intended to boost what is already inside the person. So if you are, you know, someone who is really self-absorbed, self-obsessed, you know, egotistical, yeah, they're probably going to, you know, exacerbate the meaner aspects of your personality. But if you are, on the other hand, someone who tends to be kind and generous and curious, then psychedelics might be the best thing that ever happens to you. So maybe that is the same thing with the fae folk.
Fair enough.
Well, a great point, which I don't even know where to dive off from, but sort of trying to sort of bring this around full circle to the documentary. I have a couple of main points that for anyone who's been watching along with us. There's the Marshall photograph at the end of the documentary, which I have seen probably 8 times by now, and every time I watch this documentary, I cannot see what the hell that woman is pictured.
Yep, me neither. Okay. Couldn't figure it out.
Yeah, I feel like the documentary acts like it's just something that is obvious in the frame, but it's not at all obvious to me.
No.
So if
granted, I'm horrible about seeing images in other images. I just my brain doesn't work that way. Like I don't see faces and storms and things like this because people will occasionally point out images and be like, "Look at this," and I'll be like, "I don't see."
Well,
anything
if you're playing along at home, leave that in the Where Did the Road Go forums or alternatively, don't feel bad that you don't see it because we don't see it either. But one of the so. Again, coming back to this idea that this isn't one of these like love and light feel good documentaries, is the last two anecdotes more or less of the entire piece, which respectively deal with a fae stealing someone's shadow, and a family piling into their car to escape a fae circle dance, which is like one of the most chilling things that I've heard in a long time. Like if you actually imagine that last scenario of this family speeding away and the little girl like looking up over the back of the car and watching this circle of fae folk dancing is like super creepy. I don't think I'm alone in saying that. Like it's one of the most it's one of the reasons that I keep on coming back to this podcast is because of that nuance between like, oh, this is so nice, it's like nature spirits, and all like it's also really creepy and it's not at all natural in the sense that we experience day to day life. Do either of you have anything to say about either of those incidents? Because probably the most popular anecdote from this is the fae shadow stealing element. But to me, the one that sticks with me is the family that drives away as the fae are doing their circle dance.
And that made me think of the movie Yellow Brick Road.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that?
Yeah. With the little elements of things creeping in at the edges of perception with the little sounds and stuff. Yeah.
Uh-huh, the music playing. Yeah. I had actually when I was – I just remembered this. When I was working with Earth Elementals, I had this incredibly vivid dream where I was in this underground cave and there were these people singing, and the music they were making was completely mind-blowing. Like, I can't even describe it. Like, I could hear it for a little while after I woke up, and then it went away, and there's no way it doesn't seem like it's even possible to reproduce it. And it was mostly voices, and it was just astonishing. And I was just like, okay, thank you. That was awesome.
Interesting.
But obviously not scary.
Right. Just acceptance. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was a very pleasant experience with music, and whether or not it was, you know, something my brain conjured up or not, I have no idea, but it felt completely surreal. And like I said, it's one of those things I don't know. Usually when I hear music in dreams, it's music I know.
Well, I think there's something along with
someday. Last night I had Rush in my head for some reason. I don't even listen to Rush that much.
Well, someday I might get to this in my own personal research and writing, but I think there's something akin to taste and smell that is shared with music in some ways. Mm-hmm. This sort of inception-like idea of being able to wiggle itself into your consciousness without you even really appreciating how deeply ingrained it is. Hmm. I think the idea of having music in dreams is not at all an uncommon thing. So I can see how that would really resonate because of the idea of hearing strange music in the forest and all that. Miguel, yeah. You have any thoughts on the end of the documentary?
To be honest, I don't really remember the end of the documentary.
Well, the shadow stealing.
Let's fold this into just closing statements then.
Hang on, because the shadow stealing thing, that was actually really interesting. And I think I actually was working on something else when it was running and realized I had to go back and listen to it and was like, oh yeah, that was really cool. I'm glad I went back and listened to that story. Oh, I was actually fighting with iTunes trying to figure out how to fix what was feeding to iTunes at the time. And finally I just had to stop and pay attention. Nice. Because some of the stories I was familiar with, but that one was weird.
Well, that one's probably the most famous from this particular documentary. I've seen that particular segment posted in the most of anything else. Really? Yeah. Yeah.
Cause he's talking and he was telling the story in such a weird way. I don't know if he was squinting or what, but he almost he reminded me of someone who was blind, because he was kind of like looking up slightly rather than at the camera. And he had this big grin on his face through half of it telling the story. I mean, but he didn't seem, you know, disingenuous or anything. It's just the way he was telling it. I'm like, okay, the guy just gives off this weird presence, like something's not right there.
Interesting. I need to go rewatch it for that reason. Yeah.
He was just, and I don't know what it was, you know, like I said, I think part of it was that he wasn't making direct eye contact with the camera. He looked like he was squinting. He could have been in the sun for all I know. And he was very laid back telling that story where he saw like a rainbow and this and that. And then these two beings were at his feet. He kind of was like, what are those? They're cutting my shadow off.
It's interesting that, yeah, okay, this entity trying to steal the shadow of the person, you know, that light, twilight playing a part in all of this. Makes you wonder if Ireland has such a rich tradition of contact with the fae folk is because of the way the landscape plays a part, you know, with how the sun is kind of like not as bright or not as clear as in other parts of the world. You know, you see the beautiful imagery that is portrayed in the documentary, you know, the Irish landscape, and you see the sun kind of like filtered out by the clouds and by the mist. You know, maybe that is also plays a part in whether you can perceive these twilight entities or not. You know, maybe you need to like dwindle or like dim the power of the sun in order to let the faithful come and play.
Yeah, yeah. As far as the dancing and the music, I thought it was definitely interesting and definitely creepy. You know, it has that sense of like ominousness. Like, what would have happened if they stayed?
Mm.
And the cutting the shadow, I'm thinking it would be pretty interesting if someone was walking out around and couldn't cast a shadow.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe yeah. They would have taken him. Maybe he would have died or something. But what if, just for a short period of time, he couldn't cast a shadow?
Well, what would have happened? You know, it's interesting to me because we've come back to... So, the more I get into this, and I hope that this changes because I do not want to be married to any sort of particular viewpoint, but the more that I get into this, the more it is apparent to me that certain intelligences are trying to illustrate what is wrong with our existence, or what is how we should reevaluate our perception of existence. And it's interesting to me that they always appear in the middle of anything, the middle of the day, in terms of the liminal areas between daybreak and, you know, daylight, and between sunset and nighttime, between the transitional moments of our lives. It seems to me like it's almost like sort of an advocate of modernity, or not modernity, but moderation rather. It's almost like it's a direct refutation of what I mentioned earlier, which is this idea that everything must be black or white.
Mm-hmm.
In some sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was mentioned on numerous occasions during the documentary that maybe fae folk, you know, they're not really either completely physical or completely imaginary. You know, they exist in this in-between space. And again, right. I'm fascinated by this idea of this liminality, as you call it, you know, this transition, this in-between twilight space, you know, in which everything seems to be possible.
Yes. And it's one of those things where... I think that's one of the reasons that children seem to be more receptive of the phenomena, because everything does seem to be possible.
Exactly.
Sure.
And it's not that. I do think that perception defines reality, but at the same time, I think that we can train ourselves to be malleable enough to accept. To accept the malleability of our lifestyles, even as adults.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So, any closing thoughts on the documentary as a whole? Would you recommend it, or is it sort of just Josh's pet project fever dream? Yeah.
I would recommend it if anyone's interested in the subject. I think if people are just into UFOs, they may not get much out of the fairy faith thing.
Yeah.
You know, if they're looking at it as an extraterrestrial thing, they're just going to dismiss this as kind of childish and silly. If you're interested in the folklore aspect, after the first few minutes there, it gets pretty good into the folklore lore and some of the different ways of looking at it. And I did like that he went back to Canada and found some of the same mythology.
Miguel?
And it's free, so it's not, you can just, you know, look it up on YouTube. You just have to look up Fairy Faith. The Fairy Faith, I think.
Yeah, for me, it's the best free YouTube Fairy Faith documentary that there is. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I highly recommend it. You know, it's one of the most intelligent... imaginative documentaries I have ever seen, not only dealing with, you know, this particular issue, but also dealing with this topics that might be frowned upon by materialistic science or very mundane society. You know, there was a level of respect that was given to the viewer, you know, of not saying, well, you know, this is the way it is, or, you know, you have to accept this at face value. It presented the opinion of the people interviewed, the personal interpretation of the narrator, you know, the guy who is, you know, going through this journey of, like, a very personal journey, actually, because it wasn't not only trying to connect with this, I don't know, cultural legacy that he had, but also the fact that his grandmother was the one who taught him about the Fëanor. You know, it was almost like trying to regain, well, this childhood innocence.
Yeah, that's something that we haven't even really touched upon at all, is the actual narrative and the character arc of the narrator in this particular documentary. The fact that he sort of goes from sort of this, he goes from the left of belief to the right of belief, like, not really even hardcore in any stance, but there's definitely an arc for the narrator. I believe his name is John Walker.
He's actually a documentary producer out of Canada.
And his journey throughout this entire experience is compelling in and of itself, because it's sort of what I feel like should be the urtext for a lot of us, is this idea of, like, interest to, like, it's the idea of closed interest to open curiosity, which I think is sort of the optimal version for anyone who has not had a direct experience. Yeah, sorry. So please pick up, Miguel. Didn't mean to interrupt you as I did.
You pretty much summed it up. You know, I mean, my final take, this is truly a wonderful documentary. I think, obviously, made for Canadian television, so definitely they probably didn't have the level of resources that an American production company would have had, but I actually think that worked for the best, because I almost think that if History Channel would have tried to do something like that, they would have included a lot of, you know, really annoying CGI reproductions of the alleged encounter with the Fëanor, you know.
Which again is the major selling point to me for this particular documentary is the vibe, like the weird sort of, like, very honest, open, but very sort of dark through line throughout the entire documentary. I think it excels in that sense.
And I remember one of the other things in the beginning that bugged me is when he's talking to the guy who's saying, "There's Fëanor right there," and he's pointing the camera. All you're seeing is, like, woods, and he's like, "Okay, well, I'm not seeing anything.
There's a Fëanor in my pants."
And at that point, I was wondering, why is he making me watch this? Because I hope this gets better. And yes, it gets way better. So he definitely explores it in a very full way.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, I really tried to see if there was a Fëanor when the guy was pointing at it.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. It's like, is there something there that's moving? I mean, I don't know. There's just nothing there. Okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for actually taking the time to watch this. And I hope that the listeners have gotten something out of watching it themselves. As I've said, it's a favorite of mine. It's a perennial favorite of mine. I watch it every year. And every time I watch it, I tend to peel back a new layer of something that's really been meaningful to me. So thank you so much for this episode, this whatever it is, midcast, podcast, Patreon episode. of Word of the Road Show.
Midweek podcast. Midweek podcast.
The Joshua Happy Podcast.
Yeah.
there we go.
And thank you for tolerating my stumblingness and nervousness as host. But I feel like this is a great resource that's on YouTube, and I look forward to hearing anyone and everyone talk about it at the forums. So good night and good luck.